For the week of May 7th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 365, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in the hills of Austria, I'm Michael Giltz.
Why are you in the hills of Austria?
Because I went to United Palace this weekend. It's a big, grand old movie theater up way up in Manhattan at 175th Street. Never been there before, and they show movies once a month. They have community events and theater. There's a church there. They were showing The Sound of Music on Sunday. I went Sunday afternoon with some friends and a little girl and just had a great time. It's a really lovingly, beautifully restored palace. A lot more ornate and beautiful than I expected. It was really cool looking, and Sound of Music was just a treat. I mean, when Julie Andrews comes on screen and the audience bursts into entrance applause, you know you're going to have a fun afternoon.
Yeah, because you've got at least 3.5 more hours to go.
It was a 3-hour show, and it was a lot of fun.
Well, you know, Michael, there are a number of movie theaters like that here in Los Angeles, kind of these old movie palaces, and they show movies at them, like, you know, every once in a while. Like, they'll do one or two shows The Last Remaining Seats is the program I'm thinking of that goes and does these screenings at these old movie palaces, and they are huge.
Yeah. No, this is not a regular movie theater. It's just one single screen, kind of like the Ziegfeld used to be. It was a real treat to see it. And I will have a link in our show notes where people can check it out. And if people are checking out our podcast this week, what are they going to hear about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll tell you how all those opening weekend records being set at the box office, remember we talked about those? Well, they aren't really being set at the box office. Also, Warner Music signed a new agreement with YouTube, but they're not happy about it. We'll explain why. During our book filter segment, Michael will talk about the memoir of a baseball legend that just might make a great vehicle for a movie legend of a certain age. On Inside Baseball, we'll see how cord cutting and a weak ad market have delivered a 1-2 punch to the media stocks. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office, which, whether it's set a record or not, is not setting a record. So just take it with a grain of salt. Michael, take it away.
And we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, and so on. It's nice. Everybody's paying attention now to worldwide box office. So we got a lot of people trying to keep other people honest. If we're missing some movie from your territory, do let us know so that we can include it. But this is what it looks like from the big picture. The number one movie around the world is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. $270 million worldwide, $430 million and counting since it opened up overseas last weekend. A big, big success story here in North America.
I guess I should point out now, Guardians made 41% of its $428 million worldwide in 3D ticket sales.
And thank you.
And just so you know, United States and Canada brought that average down, because in China, it was 99% of the gross. In Germany, it was 80%. In Brazil, it was 76%. And you're in Austria, Michael, where it was 85% of the gross.
And what was it in North America?
I do not know. Ironically, I knew as I was looking at these numbers.
I wasn't trying to trick you.
I was like, oh, he's going to ask. He's got me again. But I will try and find out what it was in North America. That's a good question.
Some of those countries, it opened up before this weekend. So I'm wondering if that's the total box office or just the opening weekend number percentage or what it is.
I will tell you this, that all of the figures I can find for Guardians of the Galaxy, at the volume two, the second one here, the 3D numbers are all for international territories. So that should tell you something.
No, yes, of course. But I'm just wondering whether it's for this weekend or last weekend or the total so far. But anyway, we were trying to compare this weekend because here in North America, Guardians of the Galaxy made $145 million on its opening weekend. That's a lot better than the first movie did. They set it up so well. The first movie found an audience. Now the second one, people came out quicker. The first movie made only $94 million on its opening weekend, except it didn't, because of course it opened on a Thursday, which means it actually made $11 million on Thursday, which means it made $83 million on its opening weekend. This movie also had a big Thursday. It made $123 million on Friday to Sunday. And again, I plead with all the box office prophets and all these people around the world, stop treating a Thursday opening like a Friday opening. If a movie opened on Tuesday, you would not include Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday in its opening weekend grosses. If it opens on Wednesday, you say it opened on Wednesday. Just compare apples to apples. It doesn't seem that hard to me.
Well, now here's a question, because you know, that was part of the movie 61 with the asterisk, you might recall.
We've got a decade now of movies with asterisks. Oh, new opening weekend record, except it's not because it opened on a Thursday. So yeah, it's a big problem. There's asterisks all over the place. It would be easy to go back and remove that Thursday total from that opening weekend. And you know what? When I saw people comparing, it is sort of apples to apples, because this opened on a Thursday and so did the original Guardians of the Galaxy. But when they're talking about what it made Friday to Sunday, of course, they're including those Thursday numbers. They don't have that breakdown anymore. Like, usually now people are careful enough to say, of course, on Thursday, this new movie made $17 million, which means on Friday, it actually made this amount of money, and so on and so forth. But once you get a month or two away from that, they forget all that. And they say, oh, Guardians of the Galaxy, the original, it made $94 million on its opening weekend. No, it didn't. You wouldn't say that if it opened on a Wednesday, but for some reason, because it opens on a Thursday, your mind has amnesia and you get confused.
I'm sorry.
It drives me nuts.
What are we talking about again? I'm confused. What?
Right. Well, we're going to talk about the biggest, one of the biggest films from India of all time, Bahubali 2, The Conclusion.
By the way, the way to pronounce it, as I learned, is Bahubali.
Bahubali. Thank you. I forgot to play the trailer and try and figure out the name. Bahubali 2, The Conclusion, $47 million this weekend, $150 million worldwide. And number three is The Fate of the Furious, $38 million on the weekend, $1,160 million worldwide. That is a huge franchise. What confuses me about The Fate of the Furious is, after the latest one, two weird things. One of the trade papers said, well, they should end this franchise now, as if that's going to happen. And two, someone else said, oh, let's spin off all these people. It's like,
no,
I don't think that's a good idea either, because you've just gotten rid of Paul Walker. Paul Walker died. You have a bunch of new people who've joined the franchise. You've got a big, huge new dynamic going on. It's working well. I don't think you should be doing a spinoff. That's not a good idea either.
And remember, this is a Universal Pictures movie, okay? And a franchise from Universal Pictures, which also owns theme parks in which Fast and Furious rides are part of the show and part of the entertainment.
Are they roller coaster rides, or are they part of the, do they have an actual car racing thing, or you just mean they do stage shows?
I think one of them is kind of like a, you know, stage show, and I can't even remember what the other one is.
How could it be a stage show?
Well, it's more of like, you know, they show you how the movie was made. Like, here's how we flip the cars. Here's the car on fire.
Oh, I see. Oh, cool. Okay.
And so it's not just about the movies. So even if this movie breaks even or even loses money theatrically, which it is not doing, obviously.
No, it's a billion-dollar movie and it made tons of money.
Yes. Then they can always make money on DVDs, on television, and, oh, by the way, theme parks.
Right, it's just one more element of Fate of the Furious, one that you might not think about, that it is part of their franchise in their theme park world. Absolutely. That doesn't mean they should or shouldn't spin off people. I just don't get the sense of it, and certainly shutting it down isn't going to happen. And number four is the animated film The Boss Baby, $23 million over the weekend, $435 million worldwide. And number five, the live-action Beauty and the Beast, $16 million, $1,185 million worldwide. And number, that's two movies on the charts that have $1 billion. And a third, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, which I think we can take as a given, right?
Well, it will certainly get close, because it's already at $428 million. And that's after 10 days in release. So yeah, it's doing quite well.
Well, I mean, you know, it could fall off a cliff, but it's tracking ahead of the original, you know, like 30, 40% ahead of the original. A little bit of it is front loaded, I'm sure, but the original made like $700 to $800 million. This one could well hit the $1 billion club as well, but at least two movies on our charts in the $1 billion club. Let's not take that for granted. And number six is How to Be a Latin Lover. $10 million over the weekend, $26 million in counting. We think now we have a pretty good box office figure for what it costs to make, and that's $10 million. So it's just about to triple its budget, so everybody's going to be happy. And number seven is a film from Bollywood. I shouldn't say another one, because Bahubali is from the southern region of India, so it's not technically a Bollywood film. It's not in the Hindi language.
Yeah, it's called a Tollywood film.
There you go. This is a Bollywood film. It's a biopic about a female wrestler. We've talked about it before. It came back into the theaters. It made $10 million in whatever territory it opened up in. And it's now at $33 million total. Could this be China? It's opened up in one territory and it made $10 million on its weekend. I was kind of wondering where it opened up in that it suddenly made this amount of money. And all I can think of is China.
Yeah, I think that might be true because looking at the distributor here, I do think that's the China film.
But the distributor would be the original person, wouldn't it be?
No, not in China, where everything
it would be for that country's distributor. Yeah. But I mean, Universal, it says Universal everywhere. It doesn't matter what countries it's opening up in. You're just telling me that whoever the distributor was everywhere else, it might be a different one once they're listing it now.
Well, if it's only in this one territory, that's what I'm saying.
Okay. We should check that out because that might mean another movie to open up in China that is not a Chinese film and hence add to our total of international movies that have played in China. So it'd be great to find that out. If you know whether Dangal opened up in China this weekend, let us know. How can they reach us, Sperling?
Well, you can write to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up, and you can like us there.
The horror flick Get Out is at number 8. It made $9 million over the weekend, and it passed the $200 million mark worldwide. At number 9 is Smurfs, The Lost Village. That's at $170 million worldwide. And at number 10, I think this is a Korean crime comedy. It's called Sheriff or The Sheriff or something or other. It was a little hard to figure out which movie this was and what territory, but I think that's what this is. Whatever it is, it grossed $7 million over the weekend, and it's yet another film that you can let us know about if you're smarter than we are and know what's going on there. Certainly right below that is a Chinese Hong Kong thriller. It's called Shockwave, and it stars Andy Lau, and it made another $7 million over the weekend, $56 million and counting from six territories. Looking down for any news, there is, I think that's about it.
Now, just to give you some sense here, you are correct, Michael. Dangal came in number 5 at the box office this past weekend.
In China.
In fact,
we made $10 million and it's only at number 5. Wow, that's a big market.
Yeah, 11. Well, and that's why everybody's focused on it. It's been open for 3 days. Here's the information that I have on Dangal from China. It made $11.1 million. And that's how much it's made to date. The per ticket average is, this cannot be correct, $27, okay, is the average ticket price. Admissions per showing, 29. The number of showings, 96,056. And then I have an admissions count of 2,830,738. That's how much data I have for that one movie in China this past week.
So it's early in the year. It's May 5th. We're just hitting the summer season. China used to have a quota of 34 international films per year. That was it, period. No more were allowed in. It's May 5th, the weekend of, and we already have 26 movies from around the world, including Bollywood and North America and lots of other territories, opening up in China. So they've got 8 more slots to go, which we're clearly going to hit by the time we hit June or July, and they'll still have half the year to go. So I think we can officially say that that quota system certainly unofficially is gone.
Well, right, but it's officially still there. So whenever they want to tighten it up again, they can, you know, the Chinese government can say, no. You know,
they don't need an excuse to say no to a movie.
Yeah, that's true.
They don't need a quota to say we don't want to show your movie. The fact is the quota is gone. Hollywood has been fighting this quota for years. Now they know China needs their movies, and now they need to put the pressure on them. If they feel they deserve more of the box office cut, this is the time to do it.
Well, and who was saying that for years and years that the quota would kind of have to be done away with because you're building too many movie theaters? So you either make more movies, you know, domestically, or you bring them in from elsewhere.
I think it was Sperling.
Yes,
I think it
that's Sperling right. That for years, I was saying you can't build all these stores and not put products on the shelves.
Right, and sometimes it's easier if people put product on the shelves for you. That's what happened with YouTube. They opened their house and said, we've got a great new platform. Some dude said, hey, I was at the zoo, and he loaded up his video, and that was the first video to appear on YouTube. Some dude walking around a zoo. It's been all magic ever since. And YouTube is back in the news, aren't they?
Yes. Well, Warner Music Group has signed a new deal with YouTube, but they're really not happy about it. Warner says essentially that their music was going to appear on YouTube whether they signed a deal or not. So the choice was really no money or sign the best deal they could and get at least some money for having their music appear on YouTube. Warner Music made a new deal for their publishing and recorded music divisions, but they claim it's a deal made under duress and that it's inherently unfair.
You're just a bunch of big jerks, is what Warner Brothers said to YouTube.
Well, what they're saying is, hey, look, our music appeared on YouTube since its inception in 2005, okay? And we had to run around with our little whack-a-mole hammer and say, take down that video, take down this other video, and we spent all this time doing takedown notices. Then YouTube started making money off of these videos. And we wanted a part of it. They said, oh, no, we don't want to share in the money. So in 2008, we took all of our video content that we knew of off of YouTube. We had a YouTube blackout.
Was Warner Brothers the only record label to do that?
No. I think Universal Music Group was also threatening.
Right. This is all part of the history of them negotiating and fighting with YouTube to get a cut of the money that YouTube is making off the videos.
Right. And Dick Morris, you might recall, there's a great book, How Music Got Free, about a record company executive sitting with his grandson listening to rap videos on YouTube and going, wait a second, what is all this advertising on the side? How come we're not getting any of this? This is my artist. And how that started the YouTube blackout. This was around 2008. Well, they spent the next year playing whack-a-mole again, saying, oh, wait, our music shouldn't be appearing on your website, YouTube. Can you take this video, that video, and the other video down? These other four videos are fine. The problem is they spent $2 million in that 1 year fighting all of these.
That doesn't sound like a lot of money.
It doesn't sound like a lot of money, but it's a lot of time, a lot of effort, and you're spending more money than you're getting.
What do you mean they're spending more? They didn't want to get any money at all. They wanted to be off YouTube.
Right, but what they learned is that they can't be off YouTube because of Safe Harbor, which is this provision in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that allows YouTube to say, effectively, we didn't put it there. If you let us know, we'll take it down, but you can't sue us. We're not liable for it. We're not breaking copyright if you tell us and we take it down. And that's what YouTube was doing.
Right, so now this is where we are today, and they say, fine, there's nothing we can do about it. We'll make more money if we just let the videos be on YouTube, and we can't stop it even if we don't want to because of Safe Harbor. So we're stuck. We're over a barrel. We have to make these crappy deals for low amounts of money, and we really don't like it. So what's going to change? YouTube obviously has Safe Harbor. That's not going to change legally. They can throw up their hands and say, we didn't put the videos up there. If you tell us about it, we'll take it down. But Warner Brothers and the labels all feel like, hey, they're making decent money now from streaming services, but those have like 100 million, 200 million people on them. YouTube has 900 million users, and they're making a relative pittance, like $500 million a year. So what's going to change? Are they going to be able to put some pressure and get more higher royalty rates, or what's going to happen?
Well, what's going to have to happen is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act probably needs to be rethought out because that's nearly 20 years old as it is. But you're right. So we've pointed that out in the past, Michael, I think recently, in fact, where $553 million comes from 900 million users and $3.9 billion comes from 212 million users. Now, YouTube, of course, would like to get a little bit of that $3.9 billion from its 900 million users. In fact,
they'd like to grow and get more money from the people that use their platform.
Correct.
To be clear.
So that's why they have a subscription service now.
Right. Red. YouTube Red, correct?
Yes, correct. But actually, you know, I thought that now Steve Cooper, who's the head of Warner Music Group, he sent out this email to certain employees, which of course was immediately leaked to the press. And I thought what he said in one part, he said, under those circumstances, and he's talking about the circumstances of negotiating with YouTube, he says, under those circumstances, there can be no free market willing buyer, willing seller negotiation, because effectively, he's saying, I'm not willing to sell you this content at that price, but I have no choice.
Right. So that's the complaint that they have. They're over a barrel.
Yeah. And look, if we could figure it out, I think.
But I don't see DMRC is going to change that. I don't see what could change in the DMRC that would change that situation.
Well, the DMCA could basically take away the Safe Harbor provision. And then
using digital rights management with.
I mean, and then YouTube possibly could be liable, in which case they would have to really buckle down on what's being uploaded, by whom, and whether it's copyrighted or not.
And do you think the labels would be happy about that if that happened?
I think they'd be ecstatic.
Right, but then obviously, as we point out, other sites would spring up that provide the same thing, a pirated platform where people could post videos, and it would, they'd have less control over it, and they wouldn't make any money. Instead of $500 million being generated, they would generate zero.
Right, and then, there's a little kind of interesting side note here, and that is Warner Music Group is one of the only major record labels not to be in partnership with a YouTube video platform, Vevo. Okay, so it's really actually Vevo is its own platform that's on YouTube, but I think it's Universal and Sony are a part of that group, so they're negotiating with themselves really there. They're double dipping, as you said before we began recording, Michael, is that it is in Vevo's best interest to get content for as little as possible, which is being sold to them by the very people that own them.
So now you're blaming the labels too.
Well, Sony and Universal specifically with Vevo.
So the people who really get screwed are, of course, the artists.
Correct.
They should have written books instead.
Well, if they did, then they might have a shot. They might, maybe, if they were really good at it, at being a part of our Book Filter segment. Now, Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And this is where, Michael, you pick books every week. And it's not just one. We only do one or two or 900, depending on how many you've picked this week, that our listeners should be aware of. And maybe they're good for an adaptation, or maybe they're about the industry. So what books have you picked this week for us?
Well, there's a lot of good books out this week, and I'm way behind on my reading. There's a new book by Colm Tóibín, one of my favorite writers, an Irish writer. He wrote the novel that the movie Brooklyn was based on. There's a new book by Paul Theroux. There's a new book, a fantasy book, the third in a trilogy by Robin Hobb. I've read the first two and really liked them, and I'm really looking forward to getting this final one under my belt. But the book I think might make a cool pick for people in Hollywood is Dinner with DiMaggio. This is a memoir by like this doctor who became friends with Joe DiMaggio, the Yankee great. And they started having weekly dinners or regular dinners, and they became friends and had many years together, decades together. And now, 10, 20 years after DiMaggio died, this guy has put his memories of DiMaggio down on paper. And of course, he says, what DiMaggio really thought about his teammates and Marilyn Monroe and Hollywood and fame and all that. But it's not really a dishy book. It's not a tell-all of any sort. It's more warm and personal and sort of humanizes DiMaggio, who's a bit of a cold fish, frankly, in his public dealings. He's, not the most warm, likable guy. And this gives you sort of a behind-the-scenes glimpse of him as sort of a lion in winter. And I have to say, when you think about it and read about it and start to dive into the book, you can't help thinking this would make a good two-hander in a play or a really good movie for an older actor. I mean, one can imagine David Strathairn. I don't know why he pops into my mind, but for some reason his face sort of looks like DiMaggio to me. But it'll be a good role for somebody, and I'm sure it'll happen at some point down the road.
Well, something that I never thought in a million years would happen. If you had told me this was going to happen, I would have said, yeah, I don't think so. I'm not putting my money on that one. Is that James Patterson. Okay, he's this big, literally the guy writes a book a week. Now he's doing it with partners, right? I mean, let's face it, he can't write that fast. He's got all these partners that he does it with. But I never in a million years would have thought Bill Clinton, former president, Bill Clinton, would be one of those partners.
Exactly. And yet, this time, Bill Clinton's name is on top. He's like, James. so it's Bill Clinton and James Patterson. Every other book, it's James Patterson and somebody you've never heard of. That's not true. There are actually some very talented writers who have had good careers before they worked with him. Anyway, Clinton and Patterson working together on a thriller. It's called The President is Missing, and it comes out June of 2018, and that is kind of a hoot. That is kind of a funny little thing there. Bill Clinton sold a lot of his memoir, My Life. I think that's what it was called, wasn't it?
Maybe
something like that, and that sold a lot of copies and got some good reviews. It'd be fun to see what they come up with.
Well, I'll look forward to seeing whether this book by Bill Clinton and James Patterson, not James Patterson and Bill Clinton, actually makes your list when it's finally written.
Oh, that's a good point. If it does, it'll be a big deal. Well, if it makes my, it's a big deal. They're working together, but boy, if it makes my list, then they know they've really gotten it made.
Well. You said the words big deal, so it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the folks behind American Idol are determined the show return to the air as soon as possible. They seem to be the only people convinced it should happen that fast, but apparently it will, and ABC is the front runner. NBC took a look and a pass, actually, because they suddenly realized they already had The Voice and didn't need American Idol. ABC is eyeing a launch on Sunday nights in March of 2018. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in terms of demand, but it's bizarre and fascinating. They're obviously going to rethink the show. Simon Cowell is with NBC, so if they had picked the show, he's got to deal with them now, doing America's Got Talent. If they had done the show, Simon Cowell might have been back on Idol, but that's not going to happen. Ryan Seacrest is in New York City. He just moved from LA. I mean,
in the process of moving, yeah.
He's moving to New York City. For all I know, he's here already. He probably had an apartment already. But, that's an ABC property, Live with Kelly. So, you know, they might want to run to Ryan Seacrest, but they can't do it in L.A. And they're like, no, we want the show in L.A., as if that matters. But, like, the show has to be in L.A. So they're going to be in L.A. without Simon Cowell, without Ryan Seacrest, far sooner than anybody wants it to return to. But I guess if you're going to reboot it and rethink it dramatically and make it a lot more about people voting, maybe from home, a lot quicker or easier than it was before. Maybe it'll happen, you know, that night rather than wait a day. I think that's what they're going to have to do. Some new excitement where, you know, people get eliminated right away while we watch on air. That'll happen, and it'll have to be fresh and different. And so I guess getting rid of those guys, it'll be part of the process.
Well, I think we should raise the stakes, right? Just let them out in a, like, contained environment, okay, all these artists, and really let them duke it out to the death, okay?
The Singer Games, yeah.
The Singer Games, that's it. I like it. You know what? I'm making a note to call ABC later. Okay.
Good idea.
Now, LA's hotshot conductor Gustavo Dudamel is adding a new dimension to the classical music scene, politics. He's begun to speak out about the crisis in his home country of Venezuela, which is free-falling into chaos. And really, that doesn't seem an exaggeration. It's not an exaggeration. There are mass demonstrations against the current people in power. They are occurring against a backdrop of no food, no hospitals, no medical supplies to speak of, and chaotic conditions. He's released, and this is Dudamel, he's released a public statement demanding action, and his audiences have responded passionately. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it seems like a big whoop to me. It's lovely that he spoke out in Venezuela. It's really heartbreaking. I have friends who are from there and have had family there. They've all gotten out, thank God. And they literally can't go back to visit even anybody. It's just not safe. But perhaps that has more of an impact on you in L.A.?
Certainly in Los Angeles, because Gustavo Dudamel is the head of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, or the conductor, a musical director. Yes, everybody was wondering, like, hey, Gustavo, you know, something's going on in your home country there. Are you going to say anything about that? Are you going to mention? And for years, he did not. And for like the last 2 years, everybody was looking at him going, are you going to say something here? And he finally did. And it's coming, as you say, Michael, against a backdrop of just horribleness. Everything about it, you know, you go to the hospitals, there's no medical supplies. So technically, then there's no hospitals. There's no food. People are starving to death. Literally starving to death. And the government is kind of attacking its own people. And so he finally said something. Now, why hadn't he said something before? Because he's a part of this kind of Venezuela youth orchestra, which kind of comes out of what's called El Sistema, which is music education in Venezuela. It is a part of the government. So he was kind of concerned that if he said anything, then the government might stop that program, even though it's written into Venezuela's constitution. So he was kind of seen as working with the government, but not really a part of the government. And he didn't say anything because he was afraid that, you know, his program would be cut out. And yet now it seems like, well, it doesn't matter whether it's cut out because it's unofficially cut out since there's money for nothing there. So what's the point?
Right. Well, El Sistema is interesting. I've had some books I've seen about it on Bookfilter and talked about them and highlighted them. It's more than just music education, though that's hugely important, but it really creates a sense of community and purpose, and it really is about social action and awareness. It's not just like, oh, learn to play the flute. So it's an actual movement.
Yes.
More so than you would think of when you hear music education or something like that. And so it is pretty radical in a way. So it's interesting and fascinating. I didn't know he was a part of that. But I did see that there was a student from El Sistema who was slaughtered at one of the protests. And I think that was what helped spur him to action finally. And every little bit of spotlight helps.
A 17-year-old violist. And what I love is he came out, Dudamel came out, and he gave a little, before he conducted this first symphony in the Schubert cycle that he's doing now here in Los Angeles, he addressed the audience kind of talking about this violist and dedicating the show to her. I love the way Mark Swed, the classical music critic for the LA Times, he started off his piece on this concert by saying, "No one makes history with Schubert's early symphonies. Schubert didn't. But Gustavo Dudamel did Friday night at Walt Disney Concert Hall." And then he goes into what happened. But I kind of liked his little dig at Schubert's early symphonies, which, by the way, were written when Schubert was 16 years old. So it was kind of this poignant way of tying this 17-year-old who died in Venezuela to the 16-year-old Schubert who wrote these symphonies.
Fascinating.
So maybe a big whoop, but kind of an interesting whoop.
Yeah.
Paramount announced its major financing deal with China is back on. So its Chinese partners, it called them up and said, seriously? That deal was for 3 years and around $1 billion in financing. But when Paramount was leaderless and their movies bombing, the Chinese had second thoughts. Also, it seemed harder for money to flow out of China with a major Communist Party Congress set to happen in the fall. But with new management in place at Paramount, the Chinese companies are back on board and set to finance up to one-third of Paramount's slate for the next 3 years with an option for a fourth year. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
What?
Because what I didn't hear was that the money is in the bank. They're like, okay, it's back on, but we do have these problems and issues of money coming out of China. And what they didn't say was we've got the money because they haven't had a penny yet. And from what I can tell, it hasn't arrived yet. As soon as it is, then it'll be a big deal. I'll believe it when I see it.
So when you get a check, you're all in.
Yes, send me an Instagram photo of it, or just send me a little piece so I know what happened.
What about a Snapchat photo? Would that work?
Sure.
Would it, you know, since Snapchat disappears with the, you know.
That's okay. That's okay.
Now, we don't know who is going to win the Tony for Best Play this year.
A Doll's House.
Well, apparently we do know who Michael is rooting for, and we know who is going to be up for the award next season. That would be Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, which swept the Oliviers this year and has now announced an opening date on Broadway of April 22nd, 2018. Tickets go on sale in the fall, followed immediately by even pricier tickets going on sale via scalpers an hour later. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's just an official release date. I have not had good word in London about their attempts to fight off scalpers. I know they put some stuff into place. I don't know how well it worked. I tried to Google and find some stories about that, but I haven't really seen any good follow-up. I'd love to know how that worked. And will they be doing the same thing here on Broadway? I hope so. If it didn't work great in London, they can come up with some new ideas. It seems simple to me. Got to bring your card or your photo ID, you know, show up at the box office with it. So, you know, they want to fight scalpers. They should fight scalpers. Hopefully they have figured it out.
Well, for a while, there was an issue in London with the, well, not only West End houses, but mostly concert promoters giving tickets to the ticket touts, these secondary market, right out of the gate.
Everybody does that. Everybody does that.
And
Bruce Springsteen, they all do it. You know, they all said they don't want to be embarrassed by selling tickets for too much. They give them away right away and then sell them on the aftermarket. So it's like, it's not us. You know, that's a dirty open secret.
Although Springsteen might take offense to that since he does do the ID check and he's been doing it for years.
It's happened in the past for, you know, all of them. Yeah.
Now, recently we reported the New York Times was cutting back on some of its bestseller lists. They were eliminating the mass market list and the comic book graphic novel list, just to name two. Authors were immediately worried since this meant less visibility for female authors. And remember, mass market is still huge for romance. It meant less visibility for new authors and the growing recognition for books combining visuals and text in unique ways. Well, turns out the authors may have been right to worry. Publishers have looked at sales for the first quarter of 2017 and compared them to the same period from the previous years, naturally. And all of the areas covered by missing bestseller lists have taken a hit in sales, sometimes by up to 30%. Less visibility means less reviews and less attention And that means, guess what? Less sales. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a very big deal. These are just online digital charts, but stores use them for what books they're going to promote, what books are going to go on sale, what books are going to be on the end of the aisle. I mean, what books get a bigger discount. It really affects a lot of how books are displayed in different stores around the country and online. It's a big problem. I still haven't heard a good reason for why they did it. I mean, it's just a digital chart. It's not like they needed the space in the paper, in the physical paper. So I assume they're getting all the information anyway. So how much more expensive was it to do a mass market chart? Seems like you're just slicing and dicing the numbers in a new way. And it makes no sense for graphic novels, which has been on such a huge growth curve artistically and commercially, partially because they created the graphic novel bestseller list. So it's really a head scratcher, and I hope they rethink it.
Well, I wonder if maybe the New York Times laid off their graphic, the editor that handles these particular lists, and they say, well, we just won't replace them. And oh, by the way,
it would be the same. There wouldn't be a separate editor for those two or three charts. It's just somebody handles all of them,
All right. I'm just,
It's just a statistical thing. It's not like somebody has to, It's busy work, It's like listening to the weekend box office. It's not like you have to have someone dedicated to it. But they have a system in place to get the information, which is why I don't understand, since that system's in place, how much you gained financially by eliminating those three charts. It just doesn't make any sense to me, since it's online and you're getting the info anyway.
Well, Michael, is winter coming? Not if HBO has anything to say about it, although in the Southern Hemisphere, it's definitely coming, FYI. HBO's smash hit Game of Thrones will end in 2018. We've talked about it before. But like any good fantasy author who has created a popular world, the end of a storyline doesn't have to mean the end of a series. Authors create prequels and sequels, or in the case of Philip Pullman, cover the same territory from a different perspective.
A midquel.
Yes. Now HBO is doing the same with its TV series. They have sets of writers all working on different spinoffs, planning to see which one looks the most promising and then forge ahead with one or two, or who knows, maybe all of them. At this rate, let's face it, George R.R. Martin is never going to catch up. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Season 6 averaged 23 million viewers, and that means they don't want it to go away. And it's going away next, winter or spring or summer, whenever the last episode is going to air, and they want something new. And remember, people said, oh, how are they ever going to match The Sopranos? How are they ever going to, every time they come up with a new hit, people feel like, oh my God, they're never going to match this. They did it again with the Game of Thrones, and I'm sure they'll come up with it again sometime soon. I doubt it will be the spinoff, but you never know.
Westworld was good.
Well, we haven't seen a real chart of how audience they claimed Westworld had a really great first season, but we don't know what the audience pattern and what it was exactly like. We just got the season average. We didn't see episode to episode, so we couldn't track whether it just fell all the way through or whether it built or whether audience fell a little bit and then plateaued. So I don't feel like we have a good view on Westworld yet.
Snapchat is going to start generating some original content. Maybe for HBO, who knows? They've signed a raft of deals with companies like NBC Universal, Turner, the BBC, ESPN, and more. They don't know exactly what that original content will be or how much they're paying for it. Always a great business model, by the way. But hey, if Twitter and Facebook are doing it, so will Snapchat. And on the bright side, if a video is only 10 seconds long, it won't take too much time to skip over the ads, will it? Big deal or big whoop?
Let us know when you got some programming to talk about. They're like, we're going to do it. It's going to happen. We just don't know what it is.
So maybe, much like you wanted an Instagram of the check that was written to Paramount, they could take a Snapchat of whatever content it is and send it over to you.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Of course, it'll disappear an hour later. But yeah. Anyway. Step right up, step right up. The lawsuits are flying fast and furious over work environments. Millennium Films is being sued for sexual harassment by a staffer who says the company encouraged young, unqualified women to come to work in revealing clothing, preferably without underwear.
Of course.
Yes. Actresses were regularly spoken of in demeaning terms and so on and so forth. They're not alone. The cable channel BET is facing a lawsuit over what is claimed to be a misogynistic culture. That one was filed by former top exec Zola Mashariki. I hope I'm pronouncing that name right. She claims the knuckle-dragging attitude starts right at the top. I love that Adjective, knuckle-dragging. But maybe it's just sour grapes, okay? Because Mashariki was fired while on medical leave for breast cancer. Oops.
Caught.
Big deal or big one.
I mean, you know, yeah. if you want someone to go quietly out the door, firing them while they're dealing with breast cancer is not a great way to do it. I feel like people said, dear God, if people can win a lawsuit against Fox News, maybe we can win anywhere. You know, it's like the place where you thought, well, of course they're going to be misogynistic at Fox News. And I don't know whether it opened the floodgates or whether it's just we're paying more attention to it. But it does feel like, you know what, it's a new era.
Well,
can't get away with that stuff anymore.
It's a kind of a social moment, you know. It's one of these things where everybody's paying attention to it, and now it's no longer okay to be done.
It's a teaching moment, if you like, much like our segment Inside Baseball.
Oh, wow, you're just like on fire with the segues today. And by the way, when I announce them, it makes them all the better. Okay.
All the juicier.
Yes. It is time indeed for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. And I guess
tell me the bad news, Sperling.
The bad news, Michael, is that you don't have a cord, but if you did, you'd probably be cutting it because, well, really, it's only bad news if you own media stocks. Let's face it.
So there's two things that are happening. Media stocks have taken a hit recently.
And why is that? Why is that? Because that's
pointing to two reasons, right?
Yes.
One is cord cutting. The first quarter of this year, we saw 762,000 people who had satellite or cable TV cut the cord. They got rid of it.
Right. Now, that is the largest drop in subscribers for cable satellite in one quarter. Okay. So, and much like, you know, streaming music, it was like, well, we have 1 million, then we have 2 million, then there's always churn. Yeah, there's always churn, but there's also, you know, kind of, is it an exponential increase or decrease? And they're saying, gee, this trend is actually picking up. Maybe.
That was number one. Number two is a soft TV advertising market. And by TV, we mean network television and cable channels.
Right. So they're seeing ad revenue come down.
And both of these things are perhaps not true. Or they're misleading, right?
Well, perhaps. Although remember, when you are in the broadcast market, whether it's broadcast or cable networks, you're making money from two places, ads, right? Let's face it. And also your retransmission fees. So if you're...
And the programming that you create sometimes that you own a piece of, let's not forget that.
That's true too. Yes. So that is true too. But just these two big ones, you're making money off of those things. So a per subscriber per month fee and the ad sales. However, if subscribership is falling, that means your per subscriber per month revenue is going down. By the way, it also kind of means that since you can't charge for as many viewers, that will go down as well. Your ad sales rate will go down as well.
That's right.
Therefore, less money will be made on that side of the business for media companies.
Yeah, and fewer customers paying for your cable bill, and then you're also going to have fewer people that you can sell to advertisers, of course.
Right. Now, here's...
Fewer eyeballs is bad.
Right. Here's the issue. So right now, media stocks taking a hit because, of course, effectively, these companies are saying, you should prepare, we're going to be losing some money on that side of the business. However, and this is what I think you're referring to, Michael, how many of those 760,000 subscribers went to one of these skinny bundles over the top where they get 40 channels and is offered by DirecTV, or I think now YouTube has one where it's like, you know, it's not every channel.
And Hulu and lots of people. No, it's getting to be pretty robust, you know, all the major networks, big cable channels, all the stuff you want. Yeah, this is the number that they have. They're talking about people who got rid of satellite or cable, but they don't include the people who got rid of or added digital over the top. And that's just silly. If somebody canceled their cable subscription and signed up for DirecTV, you wouldn't say we lost a customer. You know, they're still there. If they got rid of DirecTV and signed up for Time Warner Cable, you wouldn't say, oh no, the sky has fallen. You'd say, well, it doesn't matter. They're just getting their service in a different way. And so satellite or cable or over the top, it doesn't matter. People are still buying TV. The whole idea of cord cutting is sort of silly. People want TV. They now have a new way to pay for it. And that way is over the top. So I want a number of the total people.
But,
you know,
but
why are we only looking at satellite and cable? We should be looking at digital as well. How many people are in that mix? They may have even added customers. If you add in all the people who maybe embrace skinny bundles, I doubt it. But there could be even more people purchasing bundles over the top. Maybe we gained customers this year. Maybe more people. I have friends who do not have television. They don't have cable. They don't have satellite. They haven't had it for years. One in Atlanta, one in Nashville, Tennessee. Both of them pay for Netflix. One of them pays for Hulu. One of them pays for somebody else. And I'll bet you one of those two homes, those households, is going to sign up for a skinny bundle sometime. I bet it happens. And when they do, they'll be a new customer.
And at some point in the near future, we will be getting those figures. And it's not that, well, gee, there's no way to track it right now. There probably is. And these And these companies are probably figuring out a way to let the public and, of course, the stock analysts know, here's what we're adding. But here's the rub on that, Michael, as you well know. Right now, people are paying $150 for cable, right? And they're getting all these channels, and it's $150 every month.
For cable and their internet connection and sometimes their phone.
Right. However, at the end of the day, what's about to happen is people are starting to pay a third for that cable bill of their cable bill. So they're paying $40. So even if you're getting a whole bunch of people to sign up, you're basically saying, well, now I'm selling something at a third of the price that I used to get full freight on. So even though there is some churn here and 760,000 subscribers left cable and satellite and moved to these skinny bundles, it's at a much cheaper rate. They're paying for a much cheaper product at this point.
Well, I wouldn't say it's much cheaper, but it's going to be cheaper. When you add it all up, when you add up what they're paying for their total TV access, it's getting to be pretty close to what they pay for their bundles now. But it's true. There's more competition, which means prices should come down a little bit for consumers. And it is true. If you have a media stock, especially a cable company, a company that benefits from paid TV subscribers, if they're able to lower their bill even by $5, that doesn't sound like a lot to consumers. Like you go from $90 to $85. Well, that's 100 million households. That's $5 a month. That's $6 billion a year. So it's very likely that they will be losing money. And again, we've got the cable boxes. That number is gone. That $200 a year they're making off of cable boxes, which is total BS.
It's $20 billion, not two.
Yeah.
$20 billion.
That's $200 a month per person.
$200 per year. $200
a year per household, right? Yeah, so that's a $20 billion chunk that's going to disappear at some point. Not yet, thank you, FCC. But yeah, that's $26 billion we put into play, and that's a very real concern. But that is not because of somebody canceling satellite and going to cable, or cable to satellite, or satellite to digital. That number that they provided is not really germane. And maybe the advertising market's being soft is not quite germane. Why is that?
Well, again, remember, you're looking at one side of the equation. Now, okay, you're going to have to bear with me here. You're looking at ad sales for broadcast and cable networks, okay? And yes, some of that ad revenue is disappearing, kind of like cable subscribers and satellite subscribers. But where is it going? Is it just disappearing entirely? In some sense, sometimes, yes, it does disappear. Certain companies stop advertising at certain rates. However, all of that revenue, or at least some of that revenue, is being sent over to other platforms, whether it's online or digital streaming.
Right. So they may lose some money on network broadcast, but they're gaining some money online. It's not the same amount. Again, that's a little bit of a fall, but the drop in advertising may not be as frightening as it sounds.
Right. And we just are not getting that revenue figure yet, and it will be
advertising
less.
Should be advertising. It shouldn't be magazine versus what. I mean, you want to break it down, but if you're going to talk about total ad revenue for television, if your TV show is playing on abc.com, my mom's about to watch the Diana special, which she missed last night and she didn't DVR it. She's going to abc.com to play that on her tablet. She'll be watching some ads. Is that included in that total figure? Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah, I don't know. Certainly the Hulu revenue is Hulu revenue, which then comes through licensing, not ad revenue for, say, ABC. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, that's one of the issues there. What I will say is that here we have all of these cable subscribers leaving, and they're all, not all, but many of these subscribers are going to these skinny bundles, which they get over the top, which arrives via the internet. Okay, and you mentioned the FCC a few moments ago. Well, and I don't want to get into this too much, Michael, but all of this is happening against a backdrop of the FCC saying, we'd like to do away with net neutrality. We think net neutrality will still be there, but we basically would like to take internet service providers, we'd like to take them out of Title II and allow them to charge more for certain access or for providing certain access to content providers.
Which is a terrible thing that most companies should really object to strongly. There's right. about two people who benefit from that and about a billion that don't.
Right. And Ajit Pai, who is now the head of the FCC, his what really irks me is that he's going on this tour right now, this kind of media tour.
You've been irked a lot this week.
I have been, yes. And he's basically spewing out this talking point where he says, well, this is really a preventative measure. This Title II is preventative. It's not as if these companies were doing this and two-tiering the and creating fast lanes for content providers, or you know, throttling people's speeds, you know, customers' speeds based on how much they pay. And the answer is yes, they were doing that. Okay, that is why it was so important for Title II to be applied to the internet. I mean, yes, it's kind of a big hammer for something that it would. You know what the real solution is? Get rid of regional monopolies. Okay, and how does this affect our international listeners who by this point may have tuned out already? But here's the thing. Comcast now owns NBC, okay? If Comcast can earn more money by streaming NBC content to its customers in the US, then you will see more NBC shows made, and those shows will then go overseas.
Right, it all affects everybody all around the world, except that the people in the rest of the world have better internet connection,
correct,
at least in developed countries, because they have more competition.
Correct. So, sure, do away with Title II, but then also make sure that you allow regional...
No, there's no reason to get rid of Title II. We want. Isn't that the open internet? Isn't Title II the...
Well, Title II was applied to telephone companies and utilities that basically say you're treating this as a utility. You cannot.
Right. There's no reason to get rid of that. Well, keep that and allow more competition. We want the next internet company to be on a level playing field. I mean, we want net neutrality. If there's a better way to do it than Title II, that's fine. But we want net neutrality. We want all the internet companies to be on a level playing field so that the next YouTube, the next Twitter, the next whatever can get a leg up and not be treated differently. It would be horrific if phone numbers only worked for people who paid extra to reach you. You know, it would be a terrible way for business to be set up. We don't want that on the internet. We don't have it now. We don't want it.
Right. And what Ajit Pai is saying here, and then I guess we can move on from this, is he's saying, look, let's let the industry self-regulate. And that works at times when you have, say,
no, it doesn't.
Wireless communication. Here's the thing. There were Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile. They started putting caps on data. But all of a sudden, one company did away with caps, and then they all had to do away with caps. So there was a self-regulating kind of market move.
Except they haven't gotten rid of caps, because they all say we have unlimited data, except if you actually use it, in which case then they throttle you down to, you know, dial-up speed, and you're screwed again.
Well, that said,
in real practice, they have data caps.
That said, most people, I never hit my data cap. But that said,
hit it like an hour. If you ever use your phone as a hotspot, you hit it in 20 minutes.
Okay. Well, my suggestion is you look at some of the competition.
I'm not downloading movies. I just use it as my phone as a hotspot sometimes when I'm desperate. And that burns through your data cap in an hour.
Well, what I'm pointing out is that unlike the wireless market, we have no choice in the United States. There might be one provider in an area, maybe two if you're lucky. And so without competition and without a choice, the consumer gets screwed.
Right, but there's no need to make those as two choices. You can have competition and net neutrality. There's no need to make it as an either or. We want net neutrality and we want competition, and we want it now.
Wow. You know what? I think you should run for office on that.
All right.
Well, while you spray paint that what would you spray paint it on? A big...
Digital wall.
A picket sign.
It's going to be a big wall, a beautiful wall. Keep going, sorry.
Yeah, well, while you do that, I'm going to tell our listeners how they can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to us. You can rate and review us. It does not only help us out, but it helps other listeners find our show. So again, please do subscribe, rate, and review the show. You can also follow us on Twitter, At Showbiz Sandbox is our handle. You can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up and you can follow us there. That information, as well as ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find all the stories we discussed on today's episode, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group, MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's vivelafrance.com. It speaks for itself.
Okay, it most certainly does.
However, you don't need to explain it.
However, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, then please head on over to the Huffington Post or maybe michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, do not forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.